Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello. Joining me here, MLB.com national editor, Matt Myers. Matt, it's been a momentous, 2 weeks since we've last done the show. You and I have gone to three of the four corners of this country doing cool StatCast baseball stuff.
Indeed. I'm fired up, ready to go in the parlance of our pet last president. No, seriously, there's so much has happened. A ton has happened, both in terms of StatCast and just baseball stuff going on, baseball happenings in general, that when I woke up this morning, I was like, I'm very excited to record the podcast
today. That's high praise. So yeah, since we last talked, I think we were saying that in the days to come, I would be going to Boston to present at Sloan and to introduce some cool new StatCast stuff, which I did. And then I went to Phoenix to present at Sabre. And then you actually ended up in Miami at the World Baseball Classic and found yourself on TV with John Smoltz talking about StatCast and catch probability. So it's been a whirlwind for us the last couple weeks. So that is the big news, is that we did go present catch probability. And that's our big new thing, hit probability as well. We've got a lot of other interesting things coming up. But tell everybody a little bit about what it was like to explain something new like this to John Smoltz, who I've been on the air with. And I find him to be fascinating. He's really sharp, but he does not take these new things lightly. He needs to be convinced, right?
He definitely asked a lot of really good questions about, how catch probability, for example, factors in, weather and the batted ball traits. First of all, a lot of our listeners probably are familiar with catch probability to some degree, so maybe we should give, I think, one more kind of overview of what it is and why it's cool.
So catch probability is it's a metric we've defined, and it's for the outfield right now. And it's a very simple question. It's how likely was a particular ball to fall or to not fall, and based on how far did the fielder have to go, and how much time did he have to get there? And we're defining that not as batted ball time, but as opportunity time, which is the clock starting when the pitcher releases the ball. And the reason we did it like that is because we've seen guys like Kevin Kiermaier say that they can read the catcher's sign. They actually move before the pitch has been hit. And I think that's interesting. And I've had other fielders kind of tell me the same things, like the shortstop will flash signs behind their back. So that seemed like a skill. So it's basically based on those two things right now, and we'll improve this as the year goes on. We'll account for direction and we'll account for proximity to the wall. But for right now, based on distance and time, what was the probability of the ball being caught? So if you catch a ball that was a 95% catch probability, well, big deal. You caught an easy fly ball. If you catch a ball that was a 5% catch probability, you did something special. So it's not just about the number of balls caught. It's about the difficulty of balls caught. And this is really the first big step towards kind of redefining outfield defense, which is what everybody's wanted since the first day of StatCast.
Yeah, and also to be clear, distance needed is basically the optimal route you could have possibly taken to where the ball would land. It's not the distance you covered.
Right.
It's the perfect point A to point B straight line that you needed to cover to make the catch.
And we did that because we didn't want to give guys who took poor routes extra credit. If you went 20 feet out of your way, you shouldn't be given credit for going further to catch the ball. You should actually be dinged for that a little bit.
So when I was in Miami for the World Baseball Classic, I was on the air during the first game, Canada versus the Dominican Republic, talking a little bit about catch probability, which if you've been watching, you've probably seen some implementation of it on the network broadcasts. I got to say, if I could have gone back in time and tried to explain to my 12-year-old self the scenario I was in, trying to explain this cutting edge metric on live TV to a pitcher I grew up watching, dominating my favorite team, no less, it would have been kind of surreal. But it was very well received, and we were able to have a couple of really interesting test cases in the World Baseball Classic. We'll get to those in a second, but I want you to tell us a little bit more about what you presented at Sloan and at the Sabre Analytics Conference.
But just real quick, I have to let people in on kind of the window to our world. I knew ahead of time you were going to be on TV because, you told me about it. But when we were actually at a house in Arizona with just the cream of the crop of baseball nerds. So myself was there, Tom Tango was there, Darren Millman was there, Max Marquis, Voris McCracken, just the names that if you were a baseball nerd, you'd be very excited about. And we're all barbecuing, and I'm in the backyard, and I hear Greg Kane, one of my colleagues, go, Mike, Darren, get in here. Myers is on TV. And we all rushed in to see you explain catch probability. It was a very exciting moment for all of us 3,000 miles away.
So you remember where you were.
I will always remember where I was. That was very cool. But yes, as you said, so we went to Sloan in Boston, and the Sloan Analytics Conference, it's a basketball-heavy conference, but it's about all sports.
It was started, for those who don't know, it was started by Daryl Morey, GM of the Houston Rockets, who went to Sloan Business School at MIT, so it's affiliated with MIT.
Right, and from a StatCast point of view, we've got a very special place with Sloan, because that is where 3 years ago our CEO, Bob Bowman, introduced this technology in the first place. It didn't even have the name StatCast yet. It was just our kind of next-generation player tracking technology, and if you're a listener of the show, you know where it's progressed since then. So it was very exciting for myself and for Greg Kane, who is one of our lead engineers on this project, to kind of go up and give a little bit of background on what we've done over the last couple of seasons, what we're introducing, catch probability and hit probability, which we'll talk more about in a minute, and just some of the things we're really excited about showing going forward. And I will say, selfishly, there are a lot of people with a lot of presentations, but I was the only one who got to show animated GIFs of Billy Hamilton making insane catches. And while I'm half joking, I actually think that really helped visually with the presentation. People really picked up on that. And then the next week, we went to Sabre Analytics in Phoenix, where Darren Woman and Tom Tango and I, along with Mike Farron, who, a good friend of ours, gave a version of the exact same thing, but to a much more baseball-specific audience. And we did the same kind of presentation, except we let Tom go a lot deeper in some really interesting things he's talking about. He showed the shift chart, like the 15 different places a third baseman could play while a lefty's in the shift. Like, some of this stuff will just blow your mind. And I think, actually, now that I think about it, we posted the audio of that as this podcast last week. So you may have already heard some of this, and hope you enjoyed it. But yeah, it was really fascinating. And so now it's been 2 weeks or so since we kind of introduced catch probability. The leaderboards are up on baseballsavant.com, and I think we've gotten some pretty good feedback. Like, some of our friends at FanGraphs have written about it. I've seen some team blogs writing about it, the Rays and the Mariners and so on. And it's really exciting. So we kind of, we knew it was going to come, but we never really got a chance to play with it live until we put it out there and the World Baseball Classic started. So I don't know about you, but just kind of watching these games live with this catch probability in mind, I've gotten some really interesting takeaways from this.
For sure. One other thing I wanted to mention about catch probability is that, you mentioned that it's on the sort of the 0 to 100 scale, but we've also defined it into different bands. So basically, if a catch is from, 0% to 25%, really unlikely catches, we call that a 5-star play. Then 26 to 50, that's a 4-star play. Then 51 to 75, that's a 3-star play. 76 to 90, 2-star play. 91 to 95 is a 1-star play. And then sort of like there's, a 0-star play, which is basically the ultimate can of corn.
Yes, thank you for correctly saying my typo here on our sheet.
So just to give you a little sense, when we refer to something, or when you see something referred to as a 1, 2, 3-star, 4, or 5-star play, that's what we're referring to. And I got to say, immediately when we have it implemented, catch probability implemented all the big league parks, so the games in Miami and the World Baseball Classic was our first chance to see it in action. And immediately, my was like, okay, I want to see some 4 and 5 star right. plays. Granted, we've only seen about 8 games so far, which is basically, as you point out, like almost like half a night in the big leagues. So maybe it's still a minuscule sample size. But the quick, first gut reaction is 4 and 5 star plays, even opportunities don't happen as much as you think.
Yeah, we talked about this a lot, like how to set these bands. And I remember our first version, I think the 5-star plays weren't up to 25%. Initially, we had them at like 10%. And then we ran the leaderboards and we realized like the best player in baseball was going to have like 5 of these across the entire season. And that did not seem like enough. It'd be like once a week. But I think you're right. And it's important to remember, we've had about 8 WBC games, like half of a regular night in baseball. And the average I think we'll see is somewhere between 1 to 3 a night on a full slate of games. So we're not even halfway. We're barely halfway to that. So that's not surprising to me that we haven't seen that. But also the 4-star plays, the opportunities just haven't necessarily been there. And I don't know if that's just because the small sample's over 8 games, or maybe some of the teams aren't really bringing major league quality outfielders. I mean, there's a lot of things that could just be random chance.
Yeah, I think thus far the best catch in the WBC that we've seen, granted this is only the games in Miami and San Diego, was like a blooper down the right field line that hung up for a while that Giancarlo Stanton ran down that had like a 58% catch probability. That's the best that I've seen. I think it's the best that we've seen in the tournament thus far.
Yeah.
But the most interesting plays have been sort of the...
We've had some really interesting plays. All right, so here's the first one that stood out to me. And this was from the Columbia-USA game, which I think you were at that in Miami, right?
I was not at the game, but I saw the play you're talking about.
Tito Pollo, who is a Yankee minor leaguer, he made what looked like a fantastic catch. Adam Jones hit a shot to basically the warning track in dead center. Tito Pollo turns one way, he turns the other way, turns back the other way, falls down, but he does make the catch, so it's an out. We gave that a 98% catch probability. Now, let's be clear, as I mentioned before, we're not accounting for direction yet, so going straight back, we're probably making that a little bit higher than it should be. He probably deserves a little more credit for that, and that number would likely come down a little bit when direction is included. But here's the thing, Matt kind of explained before the difference between distance needed and distance traveled. Tito Pollo was 41 feet away from that ball based on his starting point to the projected landing point of the ball. He traveled 63 feet. So while he made the catch, and it sure looked cool, I mean, that's a great example of a guy making life way harder than it needed to be. You know, and I think that's where we're gonna have some pushback, I think, on the data and the eye test not necessarily aligning.
Oh, yeah, although I'll be honest, on that one, I was almost surprised that people seemed a little more confused by that one, because it was pretty obvious he took a brutal route to the ball.
It was like an S.
So that one, it was like, you know, granted, he still made the catch. So the fact of the matter is
I think it's two things. I think one is that 98% is almost 100%, which seems like it should be a gimme for every single player, which, as we said, with direction included, probably not true. And then also, you know, he's a minor leaguer. We were comparing him to the major league average. So I get that that's a little like putting him in a bad spot. But, you know, that's going to happen sometimes. The point of this is not really just to back up the eye test. Sometimes it's going to align perfectly. Like all these Billy Hamilton plays we've been rolling out, those are great. They look great. The data's great. But that's not always true. And then I feel like we always need to remind people the other side of that works as well. We can show you Adam Eaton plays where he made a nice running catch, but it didn't look like anything special. And the data says, no, that was special. He was so great, he got there and didn't even have to dive for it. So that's cool, too.
Yeah, I mean, the Stanton play I mentioned before, which was not in the Eaton class of play, you know, it was a 3-star catch, but it didn't look like anything special. It was like, oh, nice running catch. But, you know, comparing it to the next play I wanted to bring up was from that game I was at, Canada, Dominican Republic, Dalton Pompey. It was similar. It was off the bat of Carlos Santana. He needed to cover 74 feet. He went 76 feet, so it was a very efficient route.
That's pretty good, yeah.
And it was over his head, and he made, you know, a half-diving, it wasn't like full extension, but it was like a running slash diving. He ended up on the ground, diving catch, and it was in 86% catch probability.
I think you had some pushback on that from John Spelsa, but I remember watching this. So I was at this house in Arizona watching this play because he'd just been on, and I remember thinking to myself, that's probably going to get a higher catch probability than people think, because it didn't look to me like the route looked fine, as you said, the catch was fine, but it just didn't look to me like the top speed was there, you know? And that's kind of what the numbers ended up saying, right?
Yeah, his sprint speed, as we're calling it now, was 26.5 feet per second. Now, Tom Tango, who developed this metric, sort of has given a rule of thumb for each band and basically says a 2-star catch is about 27 feet per... Generally speaking, on a 2-star catch, you need a sprint speed of 27 feet per second. In this case, that was a 2-star catch. It matches up perfectly. What's interesting is that Pompey stole a base later in the game and had a sprint speed of 28.1 feet per second. So he clearly wasn't going as fast as we saw he could go on that day.
So I learned something. I didn't know that about the stolen base later on. So that's cool. But I guess like when you talk about the eye test, it sort of depends on how you're watching it. Because I watched it and I said, he doesn't look like he's running that fast to me. But I can also imagine a lot of people, you know, in the park watching it and seeing him stretch out to make this great catch, and you think, that's a fantastic play.
Again, it was one of those, it was over his head, so maybe we're sort of, you know, giving him, shortchanging him a little bit.
We're not that far away from direction. You know, if not by opening day, I think pretty soon after that, we're going to be able to incorporate that.
Yeah, and that said, I think he probably, you know, I'm guessing because he was going back, he wasn't able to reach his optimal speed as quickly as he might have otherwise. And also, it's possible because it's harder to judge the ball going your head. Maybe he misjudged how far he needed to go, so he didn't end up getting that extra gear and sort of at the end had to sort of lunge to make the catch. But again, I want to make two points. He ended up making the catch. And two, I think that one thing we're going to learn, at least this is my hypothesis after 8 games, is I think that we're going to, if we, 2-star catches are added value. Even if it's an 85% play, that's still play that's not made 15% of the time.
Well, so that's kind of a great segue into our next point, is I want to talk about where is actually a good catch. Because my initial takeaways watching this that's actually a good point. You know, we have been doing reads for some of our other sister podcasts over the last couple weeks, which I completely forgot about because we didn't do it last week. But you should totally listen to the MLB Pipeline podcast. We've had some of these guys on this show before. Both Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo have been on the show, and they are fantastic. They are just full of all kinds of prospect-related data. They join Tim McMaster each week to talk about what's going on in the universe of MLB's future stars. Last week, they actually broke down their famous Cactus League prospect interviews from spring training, which is really cool because it's a chance to kind of know these guys in person, you know, and what they value in baseball. So I've listened to this before. It's fantastic. So do search for MLB Pipeline in iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts and click subscribe. And hopefully when they do that for us, it'll be way smoother than that just was. So it's kind of an interesting question, right? Here's a play that has come up a lot, I think, over the last couple of years. And there's a lot of different reasons. So last September, Braves at Mets, right? Yoenis Cespedes is batting. It's the ninth inning. Braves are up 4-3. There's two out and two on. It's like the most important part of the game. Cespedes crushes a ball to dead center field, 102 miles an hour off the bat, projected for 395 feet. Ender Inciarte, who is fantastic. He's very high on all of our leaderboards. He reaches over the wall. He brings the ball back, right? Amazing play.
Game-ending play. Mets are in the middle of a pennant race. It was an incredibly dramatic moment. It was like seemed like this could have crushed the Mets' playoff hopes. This was about to be a dramatic walk-off win, and it turns into a crushing loss.
It is everything you want from a great play. It looked great. An all-star was batting, and as Matt said, the baseball context was just, you know, through the roof. So we have that as a 69% catch probability, which admittedly seems kind of high to start with. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is, as we said, not accounting yet for wall or direction. So when those two things are included, that number probably comes down at least by a couple points. But it's based on right now how far he had to go and how much time he had to get there. So he had to go 107 feet and he needed to go, or he actually ran 27.6 feet per second. So that actually fits into this catch probability band. So that's a 3-star play. And you kind of look at that play and you think to yourself, that feels like it should be a 5-star play. But the numbers say otherwise. Are we just being kind of a little overwhelmed by the baseball context? Or is a 3-star play actually good enough? What do you think?
I think it's both, to be honest with you. Because I think, as I said before, I think that what we're going to see is that two-star plays sometimes, and 3-star plays in particular, are really big value-add kind of plays. But I also think that in this case, you know, as we said, the wall does... The system doesn't yet know that the wall's there. So if the wall's not there, he makes that catch, like, pretty, like, it's like any other good catch in the gap. That's why you have to just imagine that we're playing on a Little League field and there's no fence.
Well, think Detroit, right? Yeah. Deep center field. That ball gets caught in Detroit 69% of the time, probably.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that makes sense to me.
So, he's definitely getting shortchanged. That said, again, the distance he had to go relative to the time wasn't that, like, outrageous relative to other catches that NCR makes. Granted, NCR led the majors last year in 5-star catches.
Yes, we are
fully aware that he is a great defensive outfielder, and that is a 3-star catch, I think we have to come to realize, is a, I don't know if great catch is the right word all the time, but it is it's a value add. I'll give another example from that Dominican Republic Colombia game, and this was actually the segment that I was, when I was on the air, because I remember it well. It was a ball to left field over Jose Bautista's head. 79% catch probability. He did not make the play. And that's the, you know, when you see a play like that, you see a guy who's not known as a great outfielder not make a play, it makes you, you know, an extra base hit, runs scores, it makes you realize, oh, like, the other side of it isn't just the plays that are made, it's seeing the plays that are a good outfielder would have made.
Well, set aside for the NCAA play, set aside the baseball, you know, pennant race, it's ninth inning, put that all aside for a second. Do you think that 2/3 of major league outfielders, given that opportunity, make that play? It's really having that opportunity is the hard part. That doesn't happen very often. Do you think 2/3 of major league outfielders can put their glove over the wall and make that play? Is that unreasonable? I don't know that it is.
It's a really good question. I think that most center fielders could make that play.
Well, so that's a good point. Right now, we're doing the average of all outfielders. We're not doing it by position. We certainly could. But to start with, we're just trying to keep it simple based on outfielders. So you're right. Maybe if that was compared to center fielders, that's a different number as compared to right fielders.
Yeah.
So that's something that's an interesting thing to account for. Speaking of fantastic center fielders, Kevin Kiermaier is in the news because Kevin Kiermaier is reportedly signing a 6-year, $53.5 million extension. And if you have followed baseball at all, you know Kevin Kiermaier is just a fantastic center fielder. He holds the single season record for the highest defensive run saved mark ever, and ever goes back to 2002. And I think what we're finding that's pretty interesting is that catch probability aligns pretty decently with kind of the advanced stats like DRS and UZR. I think some people are uncomfortable with that, but I've always kind of looked at it as if we put out a metric that says, no, Kevin Kiermaier is bad and Matt Kemp is great, then we are doing something extremely wrong. I mean, it probably should align somewhat, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and not to give StatCast too much credit, but it almost felt like the Rays were like, oh, shoot, like all these great metrics are coming out. They're going to show that Kiermaier is even better than people realize. We better lock him up now.
Yeah, and so we have got like a million different great numbers on Kevin Kiermaier. Overall catch probability from last year, this is regardless of difficulty, just the number of balls that were catchable, he got to 94% of balls he could catch, and that was the best in baseball. And so right there, that tells you a lot about Kevin Kiermaier. This is my favorite stat I think I've ever found. So last year he got hurt. You know, he broke his hand. He's out for a couple weeks. Obviously had some other days off. So he started 102 games last year. When he was starting, Tampa Bay allowed 3.8 runs per game. When he was not starting, Tampa Bay allowed 5.5 runs per game. Now, let's be fair, I have not controlled for quality of pitcher, quality of opponent, anything like that. This is just raw what happened. That is amazing to me. That's a huge difference. I mean, that's, I mean, if you're looking for a way to say he's the MVP, I mean, that's value right there. We also, you know, we dug a little deeper. So we talked about 5-star plays. And I like to combine those, I think, with 4-star plays, because that gets you all the way from 0% catch probability up to 50%. So basically balls that fall in for a hit more often than they don't. Who did the best at turning those likely hits into outs? Number one, Kevin Kiermaier. He did that on 65% of his opportunities. And you look up and down this list more than passes the smell test. Billy Hamilton, Jerod Dyson, Keon Broxton, Adam Eaton, Jankowski's on this list. Matt's boy, Jake Marisnik, is on this list. Juan Lagares. I mean, these are the best of the best. Surprisingly to me, Desmond Jennings makes the list. And I actually asked a Rays scout about this recently, and he said, yeah, it doesn't surprise me. Like, I know we cut him for a lot of different reasons, but, you know, when he was out there and healthy, the defense still looked pretty good. So that kind of makes me feel pretty good about something that sticks out to me on a data perspective, standing up from a real world perspective. And I said that Kevin Kiermaier caught 65% of those 4- and 5-star balls. The MLB average, 19%. Kevin Kiermaier is amazing. And that's, he's getting paid for this.
Yeah. I mean, it's because of all the different things that he can do. And obviously the fact that, you know, the Rays didn't have to compete with him in the free agent market. It's, you know, it's a 6 years, $53.5 million. It's a kind of deal where it's like, it's pretty win-win for a guy who was a 31st round pick in the Rays. Like, they're never going to regret, with the dollars at hand, having Kiermaier on their roster. Even if, like, his batting craters, which it's actually improved to the point where he's pretty...
I think there's more breakout potential left there.
This is definitely the definition of a win-win deal.
For both sides. And you're right, you know, Kiermaier got, I don't even know what it was, but a very low bonus as a 31st round pick. So now he's set for life. The Rays probably, if he plays up to expectations, the Rays will save some money because, you know, he won't make what he would have in free agency for 3 years. So, you know, listen, we can sit here all day and probably talk about Kevin Kiermaier, but here's what I thought was cool. As we said, we put out Catch Probability and we got a lot of articles that were written about it. One of them I thought was very cool was at FanGraphs by our friend Jeff Sullivan. And he basically did something interesting. I thought he took the expected catch probability in each of those bands, and he just did a very simple plus minus, like who caught more or less in each of those bands, and combined them. Number one, Kevin Kiermaier. Number two, Billy Hamilton. I mean, that makes perfect sense. And Kevin Kiermaier being the number one outfielder in baseball, that sort of aligns with what I'm seeing. I kind of look at it in two different ways. Billy Hamilton is the number one highlight outfielder in baseball. He makes the most unbelievable catches. He's better at this than Kevin Kiermaier is. But just in terms of getting two balls, Kevin Kiermaier is probably unparalleled in baseball. He's number one as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, no, and I think that this is, you know, these new, you know, obviously defensive metrics have sort of hit a little bit of a wall. So it's just so cool to be able to sort of a new way to contextualize them and sort of, you know, be on the ground floor and be able to sort of see them in action.
Yeah, you sort of want to thread the needle between, okay, we've got interesting data to tell a cool new story, but also not totally invalidate everything that's come before. And I'm hopeful we're doing that. The guys you think are great are still great. And then I think you're going to see some interesting outliers. Like, you know, Odubel Herrera, I think he didn't necessarily look that great by the advanced stats. I think we have him looking pretty decent here.
Yeah.
So I'm writing something else right now. You know which team actually looks a lot better by our metrics than they did by DRS? Last year's Texas Rangers. I was very surprised by that, you know, because like Carlos Beltran isn't that great. They actually look a lot better. So I think that'll be interesting to see where the two systems disagree and figure out why.
Well, the Herrera thing is interesting because I remember when the Phillies gave him an extension recently, and this was kind of before really we finalized catch probability. Todd Zielecki, our Phillies reporter, asked us, like, hey, Klentak at the press conference or the conference call after the signing, you know, mentioned how their metrics really valued Herrera's defense, and some of like the advanced metrics that previously met publicly available were like pretty lukewarm on him. But to see him here, and we know that the Phillies right now are kind of, you know, a cutting edge team in terms of what they're doing with this kind of data. Now I'm starting to see where Klentak was coming from.
So when I look at Jeff Sullivan's list here of the guys who had the most plays above average over the last two seasons, look at Kiermaier, sure. Billy Hamilton, sure. Lorenzo Cain, absolutely. Jake Marisnik. I know you've been dying to talk about Jake Marisnik. I think we had him as a crazy good arm strength guy entering last year. He plays for the Astros, has never hit even a little bit. But Jake Marisnik here, fantastic outfield.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, that's, to me, Jake Marisnik, I'm fascinated. I think that he's actually... He basically is the poor man's Kiermaier because he, like Kiermaier, he has the amazing outfield range and also a cannon for an arm. That's actually what separates Kiermaier from Hamilton and some of these other guys as the best outfield in baseball. It's not just that he has the range, but he can throw, literally throw 100 miles per hour.
Yeah, there were I think like seven or so outfielders who hit 100 last year, and Kiermaier was definitely one of them.
And Mariznick is right up there with him in terms of arm strength. So you look at Jake Mariznick and you wonder why, how does a guy with a career 268 OBP have a spot in a major league roster? And you look at what team it is, maybe the most, you know, analytically minded team out there, or certainly in the top tier, the Houston Astros, and you begin to understand why, because you have to imagine that they see the value in his defense as well. And now I think this is actually a really good segue to the next team we want to talk about, because when I brought this up with Tom Tango asking about Mariznick, the player he mentioned was Robbie Grossman, who had previously been, who basically Mariznick essentially replaced on the Astros roster. And Robbie Grossman is a really good OBP guy, who's a decent offensive player, but all looks pretty poor in advanced metrics.
Yeah, I mean, the exciting thing about this is you can slice and dice this data any way you want and come up with interesting stories. So the team that Matt is alluding to that I'm really interested in right now is the Minnesota Twins. And I think we've talked about Byron Buxton a lot on this show, and this is going to be yet another way to write a love note to Byron Buxton. But we looked at last year just what team made the most five-star plays, right? Which team had just the highest percentage of the best of the best plays? So tied for first, okay, number one, the Reds, unsurprising because Billy Hamilton. And number two, the Minnesota Twins, though. They both had 18, right? Just above the Royals and the Braves and the White Sox. You know, Kane, Inciarte, and Eden, so that all makes sense. But here's what's really interesting to me. Making the most five-star plays doesn't necessarily make you a great outfield. So the Twins tied with the Reds for the most five-star plays. The Twins were also fifth lowest in overall catch probability last year. And these teams make sense. Arizona, obviously, Pollock got hurt, Peralta got hurt. They traded Inciarte. They were playing backup infielders in the outfield. That makes sense. St. Louis, a lot was written about their defensive struggles. Houston, Pittsburgh, I guess a little bit surprising, but maybe not Pittsburgh because we've talked about McCutcheon on the show. And then the Twins. They did a very poor job of getting the balls overall. This has really been the Twins story for years.
I'm guessing Robbie Grossman has something to do with that.
So Byron Buxton is awesome, but Byron Buxton only played like 50% of the innings because he's hurt and in the minors. Max Kepler is looking like he's going to be pretty good. He also played about 60% of the innings because he didn't come up till June. So yeah, Robbie Grossman was, if I think, in the bottom five of all of our tracked outfielders. I think it was like him and Tyler Goodell and Domingo Santana really did just a below average job of getting to the ball. And the Twins know that. I saw Rhett Bollinger, our Twins.com beat reporter, writing about how hard he's working to improve that defense this year. You know, they had other guys playing out there like Oswaldo Arcia. Guys who aren't going to really be playing a ton of, Miguel Sano played half the season in right field. Guys who are not going to be playing a lot of outfield for the Twins in 2017. So I think that's kind of an interesting story. You see, you know, the young guys come up and make these incredible plays. It wasn't quite enough to overcome kind of the rest of it, the inconsistency of the other guys. I'm really excited to see the Twins. And right before we came on the show, I was watching a Twins-Cardinals spring training game that my parents happened to be at because they live a charmed retirement life. And in one inning, I saw two great outfield plays. And it wasn't even Buxton. I don't even know who was playing center. But
one other thing to consider is that we're talking about raw numbers here. And again, I haven't run these numbers. But I have to imagine the teams that made the most five-star plays also didn't have great pitching staffs. So it might also be a factor of maybe some more opportunities to make five-star plays.
That's a great, very, very good point for two different reasons.
A lot of barrels, a lot of hard-hit balls to the outfield.
I mean, it doesn't matter how good of an outfielder you are, you cannot make a five-star play if the opportunity isn't presented for you to make that play. So you're absolutely right. You know, the Twins, the Reds, the Royals, the Braves, these are not strikeout staffs. These are guys that are giving up a lot of. So you're right. So I'm guessing that the Cubs probably rank relatively low on this list, even though they had great outfield defense, but for two reasons, right? Number of batted balls, yes, but that's also positioning because we're using the starting point of the outfielders, and our extremely, extremely preliminary look at positioning says the Cubs probably did a really good job at positioning. So if you're Jason Hayward and you're not getting your pitching staff is very good and you're not getting a lot of ripped liners and you're already starting closer, we have to figure out a way to not unfairly penalize him just because those balls don't exist. And that's always been an issue. That's always going to be an issue, but it's definitely something, you know, I think we're thinking a lot about. So we talked a lot about catch probability. I don't want to undersell hit probability because we introduced that as well. Hit probability it's pretty cool. It's the same idea, but it's from the batter's point of view. It's basically at the point of contact, the batter has put an exit velocity on the ball. The batter has put a launch angle on the ball. And based on those two inputs, you can tell an enormous about where that ball is likely to go and how likely it is to fall for a hit. And right now we don't account for horizontal spray angle, but we will incorporate for that later. Because if you think about it, you know, I think a great example we use is from last year's wild card game, right? Brandon Belt just destroys a ball off of Noah Syndergaard, crushes it like 106 miles an hour or whatever to dead center. You know, as soon as that ball leaves his bat, he has no more impact on it, right? Whether the ball falls for a hit, whether the ball is caught, that's really not on him any longer. So it just so happened that Curtis Granderson made an unbelievable play in center field and robbed him. So Brandon Belt gets an 0 for 1. That ball lands for a hit. I forget what the number was, like 85% of the time?
More than that.
More than that, right. So Brandon Belt did his job. He showed amazing skill to really barrel up a Noah Syndergaard pitch, which is not easy to do. We want to give him credit for that skill, even though somebody else did an amazing job, too, to rob him of a hit. So that's hit probability, and you can see how it's easy to apply that not only for the hitter, but also for the pitcher. If the pitcher induces a weak fly ball that has a 5% hit probability and the left fielder happens to lose it in the sun, are we really going to kill the pitcher for that? For 100 years, yes. But for now, no, we don't have to do that. We can apply credit for the skill that he showed, and I think that's really cool.
And one other aspect of it that, you know, has been a bit of a discussion point is whether or not to involve batted ball direction. And the decision made, you know, in creating this metric by Mr. Tango, which is basically like, use David Ortiz as an example, like someone who's shifted all the time. If he hits a ground ball to shortstop, that's 99% out for anyone else, but a hit for him, you know, it's a weak ground ball. How do you score that? And I think that the point, the fact of the matter is, what we're trying to do is just rate the quality of contact and direction. Hitters aren't really trying, like, they're trying to hit the ball hard.
But I do think we'll have a version of this that does have that included.
Yeah.
And so
I think eventually, but I'm saying right now, that's the rationale. I'm just trying to explain rationale for it.
Yes. So you can see how that's going to be interesting, and that's just individual plays. You can bubble that up and accumulate it for an entire season. So I think we've talked before about how Kyle Hendricks actually looked fantastic, even without the Cubs defense behind him, just based on quality of contact and strikeouts. So getting back to the WBC, Team USA had a really interesting game the other night, like two home runs in I think the eighth inning. And our Andrew Simon wrote an interesting piece on Eric Hosmer, who kind of hit two very similar batted balls.
Almost identical. In the fourth inning, he hit one 103 miles per hour, 34-degree launch angle to deep right center at Petco Park. Caught, you know, a foot in front of the wall by Ender Inciarte.
Of course it was.
but it was a routine. It was a high fly ball, and it died on the warning track. In the eighth inning, 102 miles per hour, slightly lower exit velocity, but 25-degree launch angle, line drive. That one goes over the wall, 404 feet, a little more to right field, but 404 feet would have been out basically anywhere in the park. The first one was 387 feet. So it kind of shows you how a little bit of launch angle can make a huge difference. In this case, it was 9 degrees difference and 17 feet, which, you know, and that when you're talking about the difference between 387 and 404, that's a big difference. That's the difference between a flyout and a home run.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about Hosmer on the show a couple weeks ago when the story came out that he was potentially looking for like some insane 10-year, $200 million contract, which he's never, ever going to get. But I think the point was made at the time that he actually hits the ball hard enough but on the ground too much. And we've talked endlessly about you got to elevate, right? And we're going to have some interesting stuff coming about that in a couple weeks. But I think you've got something cool now about how he's not been doing that.
Yeah, no, last year among the first basemen, the 23 first baseman that put at least 250 balls in play, he had the lowest average launch angle, and not just by a lot. He was last at 6.5 degrees, and the next lowest was Will Myers at 8.8 degrees. Now, for context, the aforementioned Brandon Belt, 20.2 degrees.
The extremely underrated Brandon Belt, because he would have a lot more home runs if they didn't all die in that triples alley out there.
But, you know, as we talked about Hosmer a couple weeks ago, I said that, you know, I'm sort of the belief that he's the kind of guy that if he kind of underwent one of these swing overhauls, or at least, you know, approach overhauls, and tried to basically just only hit fly balls, he has the power and the, you know, the bat speed and the swing. Like, he's in the top 10 in batted balls over 100 miles per hour last year. So he hits the ball hard. And then last night he saw two almost identical, like, these are the balls he should be trying to hit, which is like these deep fly balls to right center field.
Yeah, and that's such a big topic, like elevating. And as I said, we're working on something cool. I just have to share one quote we got from one of our writers, because we've been asking our beat writers to identify specific guys and ask them about getting the ball off the ground. And one guy, and I'm going to save the surprise for later, said, if I go 0 for 4, but I hit all four balls in the air, I had a good night. I thought that was awesome. I love that so much. We're gonna end the show here on something that I swear was Matt's idea. I didn't suggest bringing this up, but we're going to talk about Seth Lugo again. And here's why. Seth Lugo is actually starting for Puerto Rico in the World Baseball Classic on Friday night.
Against
America.
Marcus Stroman in the United States.
Which is actually a pretty fascinating matchup. So, you know, you've listened to the show. You know that there's a ton of really interesting Seth Lugo spin rate data. He's the king of curveball spin. There's really kind of two points I wanted to share here. One is that, you know, we talk a lot about his high spin rate on the curveball, and that's cool and all, but people say, so what? You know, was he a great pitcher last year? And I would say, well, you know, he had a 267 ERA, so in terms of outcome, he certainly helped the Mets do what he wanted to do. But, you know, what does it mean to have high spin on a curveball? So Seth Lugo has an average of like 3,300 something on his RPM on his curveball. So when you look at the bands, I kind of split this into three. If you have spin rate of 3,000 or higher, you know, whiff per swing, so 38% misses every time you swing at a ball, right? And guys hit 174. You put that up between 2,400 and 3,000, well, that whiff per swing drops from 38 to 32%. Batting average goes up by 30 points. You drop the RPMs from 1,800 to 24, batting average goes up by 30 more points. Whiff per swing drops to 12%. So it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. Obviously, it's part of your repertoire. Great spin doesn't make you great, just like great velocity doesn't make you great. But those are pretty startling numbers to me. So I look at that and I see, this is a guy who should use his curveball more.
You know, the thing about Lugo, and I think that he's the perfect example of a guy who seemed an otherwise ordinary pitcher, but because of Statcast became like an instantly fascinating pitcher. And, you know, we only had like 10 starts from him last year. So I'm very curious, you know, whether he's, you know, a swingman for the Mets, bullpen, whatever his role ends up being. I'm just very curious to see how this manifests himself now that the league is aware of sort of what his shtick is and what he does and, you know, how he's able to sort of maybe harness his curveball more, knowing that, hey, it may actually be elite in a way that I didn't realize.
Yeah, and just to show that we are not always going to unreasonably pump up like the Mets' seventh best starter because he's got great curveball skin, let's go back to hit probability for just a second. So what I'd mentioned is that you can do this on every individual batted ball, what quote-unquote should have happened. You accumulate that over the course of a season, and if you include, you know, for strikeouts and walks, you can kind of see who really was just the most effective, right? So Clayton Kershaw, unsurprisingly, by far the best pitcher in baseball because he gets very weak contact when you're lucky enough to make contact. So you can rank guys like that, but what you can also do is look at their actual outcomes compared to their estimated outcomes. So, for example, Kyle Hendricks is actually very close. He, quote-unquote, earned all of it. It wasn't that the Cubs defense was pumping him up. What happened off the bat is basically what happened in real life. 501 pitchers last year faced at least 100 batters. And when I looked at the biggest difference between actual OPS and estimated OPS, who was number one on my list? Seth Lugo. Now, I laughed that he was number one on a totally non-related to curveball spin list. This doesn't make him look great, though. His actual OPS against was 666. His estimated was 840. And if you think about it, he didn't actually like pile up great peripherals. I think he struck out like 6 per 9.
No, and he stranded like 95%.
Unsustainable, like batting average on balls in play. So, you know, I'm not saying that this is, we still have to learn more about how predictive this is going to be, but that's 501 pitchers, and he's number one on that list.
Again, you know, we've seen pitchers now rely on their curveball more, which used to be, oh, you know, you don't want to pitch backwards. You want to pitch off your fastball. You know, maybe he is the kind of guy, now that he realizes, you know, what his curveball is, maybe he becomes that guy and can be a different pitcher than we saw last year. Because, you know, what we saw last year was a guy with a really interesting curveball who was probably not that good.
I think he should take the lesson of Rich Hill and throw that curveball more. And I've seen him say he didn't actually think he had his best curveball last year, which once I blacked out and woke up like 3 hours later from seeing that, I was very excited. That's our show. Thanks to everybody. I had a couple people come up to me over the last couple weeks and say how much they enjoyed listening to the show, people inside the game and outside the game. So thank you for that. Lots of really exciting stuff to come up this year. Make sure you watch the WBC, and Catch Probability and Hit Probability are going to be really exciting for us. Can't wait to talk about it more. I'm Mike. He's Matt. This is the MLB.com StatCast podcast.